Hi, welcome to another segment of Home Buyer Education. Today we're going to cover the purchase contract. My name is Ed McNamara. I'm with Bean & Dunn Real Estate in Oklahoma City. If you have any questions about today's segment, you can contact me via email at McNamara, that's McNamara, at OKCRealtors.com, or feel free to give me a call anytime, area code 405-606-8442. At the end of the segment, if you would, again, I'll ask you to make some comments. If you like the segment, if you think that we need to improve some areas, please leave a comment either on iTunes or Podomatic. It does help get the program noticed and forwarded on to as many people as we can. Also, if you know of somebody that's in the home buying mode and you think they might benefit from the program, make a recommendation for them to listen to the segments. We think that's going to help. Because this particular segment is on purchase contracts, I do want to make a disclaimer. I'm not an attorney. I cannot give legal advice. We always recommend that anytime you deal with contracts, you have someone either licensed or have an attorney review a contract if it's not written by a licensed person. If you would like to see examples of the contracts that I'm talking about, I did put some links on my website. The website is homesforsaleinoklahoma.com. That's HOMESFORSALEINOKLAHOMA.com. Homesforsaleinoklahoma.com. When you get to the main page in the website, look for the Investors tab, click on that, and then you'll see blue highlighted links to the purchase contracts and to the disclosures. If you want to refer to those contracts as we talk, you can do that. I don't follow the contract paragraph by paragraph, but you can get an idea of what I'm talking about. Or you can just take a look at them when you're finished listening to this podcast. Contracts can come in many different forms. You can buy pre-printed contracts at Office Depot. They're pretty good. They cover most of the segments that I'm talking about here. If you're dealing with a real estate company, you'll have board-approved or state-approved contracts. Typically, those contracts are written by attorneys, and so they have some legalese in them. Just make sure you understand them. In most states, you probably have to be an attorney to originate a contract. In other words, take a blank piece of paper and write out a contract. You should be an attorney. If you're not an attorney and you originate a contract for your own use, probably should have someone review it to make sure that all the laws within the state that you're in are being observed. But you should also have someone review it for clarity. When you write a contract, or even a fill-in-the-blanks type contract, in your mind, you know exactly what you wanted to say. But it may not be so clear to someone else. And when you write a contract and you have a contract between two people that has to be interpreted by other agencies like the mortgage company, the title company, the insurance company, you want to make sure that you haven't left anything to interpretation, that it's clear and concise and says exactly what you want it to say. So have someone else, and not necessarily a professional. It could be just a friend who is not in the real estate business or the loan business or is not an attorney, just to see if they understand exactly what you're trying to say. Before you sign any contracts, make sure you completely understand what you're signing. I've had a lot of people come in where we write them a real estate purchase contract, and they don't want to take that. They trust me. I don't want to be trusted. I want to make sure that they understand exactly what they're signing. So I like to take my time. It takes me about an hour, hour and a half to go over the contracts in detail and explain each paragraph to make sure that they know exactly what they're getting into. There is no standard nationwide contract. Each state, possibly each city, has their own form of real estate purchase contract. That's why you should always have someone else review it. But there are some basic items that are in contracts. Those that I'm going to talk about today, for instance, start off with property description. The description is both a legal and physical. For instance, Lot 001, Block 002, Eagle Heights Edition, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma 73102. That's the legal description, but it also has a physical description of 123 Easy Street, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma 73102. So you have a legal and a physical description. That way there's no question about what property you're trying to buy. The terms are what you're offering. If you're going to purchase a home and you're going to offer $100,000, that's the terms that go in the contract. Clear and concise. The condition of the property should be disclosed to you prior to you signing the contract, and that should come from the seller. In Oklahoma, there's a 3-page document that the seller fills out disclosing everything that they know about the property. Is the plumbing in working condition? Is the electrical in working condition? The heat, the air, the lights, anything that's included in a house, it asks what the condition of that item is. Does it work? Yes, no, not installed, whatever the condition is. So that should be fully disclosed to you and for your review prior to making an offer on the property. Does the contract allow for a warranty? Is the seller going to offer any kind of warranty on the property? In some cases, the seller is not willing to pay for the property, but you as a buyer can purchase a warranty. There are several companies in the United States that offer a 1-year warranty, ranging anywhere from $350 to $550, depending on what you want. They have options that you can purchase as part of the warranty to cover a sewer system, to cover a septic system, to cover a well, to cover a pool, to cover outbuildings, fireplaces. There may be specific riders to the warranty that can be included. The nice thing about a warranty, especially in that first year, where if you're not used to paying a large monthly house payment, if something were to break in the house, the warranty is going to cover it minus a service call. For instance, here, you pay $350 for the warranty. If the water heater breaks during that year period, they'll come out, and if they can't fix it, they'll replace the water heater and you pay a $55 service fee. So it's probably worth it. And this certainly can put in the contract that the seller is going to pay for the, at least for the first year. After the first year, you can renew it and pay for it yourself. Some companies do allow you to pay it on a monthly basis. Know what is included in the home. Some things are obvious. Some things aren't so obvious. We run into a lot of cases where we went in and previewed the home, liked it, wrote a contract, and then just prior to closing went back through and they had changed out, took out all the expensive ceiling fans and put in real cheap ones, took out the real high dollar stove and put in a cheap one, swapped out microwaves. I mean, whatever you can think of. So make sure you know what is in that home at the time that you put in the offer. So if it's a GE flat top stove that's a $700-$800 stove, make sure you remember that. The best thing to do is take pictures of the house so that you have some evidence. Hey, listen, this isn't the ceiling fan that was in the house at the time I wrote the contract. Because most contracts will say that the house has to be in the condition equal to or better than it was at the time that you wrote the contract. So go through and take a bunch of pictures. Title evidence. Believe it or not, there's been a lot of people who have sold homes that don't own them, specifically renters. You go there, it's a for sale by owner, the person answers the door, you're interested in buying the home, they say, sure, come on in, you write a contract, you give them a $1,000 deposit, and then the next time you go back, the house is empty and your $1,000 is gone. Number one, don't ever give a deposit directly to a seller. If you're buying a for sale by owner, have a third party hold that deposit with clear instructions on what to do with a deposit if there is a dispute between the buyer and the seller. Typically, it's turned over to the court system. So if you don't end up not wanting to buy that home and you get into a dispute with the seller, don't let the seller have the money. Go to court and sue them to try to get it back. There should be a paragraph talking about taxes, assessments, and prorations. Typically, the seller is going to pay the taxes from the 1st of January to the day of closing. So if you're closing in on May 31st, 2007, don't know if that's a Sunday or not, but if it's a Friday, May 31st, 2007, the seller is going to pay from January 1st to May 31st. That money is going to be credited to you on your closing statement, and then at the end of the year, you're going to pay the full year. So you will have gotten 5 months of taxes from the seller from the time that they lived there, but you're going to pay 12 months at the end of the year because it's going to be given to you. Assessments are things that typically the city might assess: sidewalks, improvements to the property, easements, anything that's assessed against the against that specific property that may cost you money in the future has to be disclosed to you. In most cases, the title company will be able to find that stuff when they do a title search, because it's probably going to be something that's filed in the court system. But that's something you need to know about. Closing and possession. In Oklahoma, closing and possession is the same day. If you close on May 31st, you get possession on May 31st. I think there are some states out there that typically possession is delayed. I don't like that at all, because you can imagine the amount of damage a seller might be able to do to a property in 2 weeks. So if you close and 2 weeks later you get possession of the property and the seller already has their money, what kind of recourse do you have? We typically do not like to write contracts where the seller is going to stay even 1 day beyond closing. Also, you have to make sure that there's a default clause. Default clause would be against the buyer or the seller. So if someone defaults, there has to be some kind of recourse. The recourse typically on the seller side, if the buyer defaults, is they get to keep the earnest money or deposit. On the buyer side, they can sue the seller. In most cases, you're going to agree to go to mediation first. Before you take someone to the court system, you're going to agree to sit down with a disinterested third party, a mediator, and try to hash things out between the buyer and the seller. If you can't, then you're typically, it's okay to take that person to court and see if you can get legal remediation to whatever the problem is. The contract, once signed by everybody, is a legal binding contract upheld in a court system. So make sure that everything is in there before you sign it. The other thing that should be in a contract is an acceptance time. So if you deliver a contract at 4 o'clock on a Friday, you might put in there that the seller has to respond to your offer by 9 p.m. that day, especially in a market where the properties are selling like hotcakes. Don't give that seller time to receive another contract, because until it's signed by all parties, it's not a legal binding contract. If you wrote an offer that's kind of a lowball offer and the seller responds with a counteroffer before 9 p.m. on Friday, that property is still not under contract, because not everybody has signed all parts of the contract. So until you sign the counteroffer, that property is still available for somebody else to come in and present the seller with an offer. Once it's signed by all parties, then the house is under contract, and typically it's pulled off the market and the seller does not continue to accept offers. And that's something else that probably should be in the contract, clearly spelled out, that once the seller accepts your offer and you start the process, they can no longer entertain other offers. Whoever ends up with a deposit, make sure that they sign a receipt, and that's typically in the contract as well. $500 to be held by First American Title Company, and then you take it over there, and they sign the contract as having received that deposit money. And oh, by the way, the check is cash. If you give $500 as a deposit, that money will go into the title company's escrow account or the real estate company's escrow account. Who's ever going to hold that deposit other than the seller? That check will actually be cashed and put into a bank account and held until closing, and then credited to you as part of the money you need to bring to closing. The other thing that should be in the contract is the property condition addendum. That's where you're telling the seller what the condition of the property has to be, what is included in the property, and so on and so forth. So there should be some kind of an addendum specifying the condition of the property. The stove has to be working, what's included in the property. If the house was built prior to 1978, there should also be a lead-based paint addendum. The lead-based paint addendum, you can find that on the HUD site. It specifies and allows the seller to disclose to you what they know about whether or not there's lead-based paint in the house. Most sellers don't know, unless it's been specifically tested and there's a special device that will test for lead-based paint. Most sellers do not know whether or not there is or is not. There is a very good pamphlet, again, on the HUD site that explains the dangers of lead-based paint and who it's most likely to affect. So take a look at that if you're buying a home built prior to 1978. The other thing that's very important in a contract is to have a financing contingency. If you have to borrow money to buy that home, the seller has to understand that your purchase is contingent on the mortgage company loaning you the money. And there's 100 reasons why that might not happen. Most people think that, nah, no problem, I can get a loan. And for some reason, the mortgage company doesn't think so. But so make sure that your contract has a contingency that specifies that you must be approved and receive money from a mortgage company before they can buy that property. And it also should say that the home has to appraise for at least the purchase price. Because if there's no clause in there about how much it should appraise for, if you've offered $150 and it only appraises for $140, you're going to have to come up with a difference because you have a legal binding contract. If there's something that has to happen before you can purchase, make sure that gets in the contract as well. Typically, that is if you own a home and that home has to be sold before you can buy this one, that has to go in your contract and it has to be very specific. For instance, I would say this purchase is contingent upon the buyer selling the property at Lot 1, Block 4, Eagle Heights Edition, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma 73102. Must be closed prior to the purchase of this property so that you can take the proceeds from that house and apply them to the purchase of your new house. Now, if it isn't required, if you can afford both payments, you might not want to put that in there. It's up to you. But if that purchase is contingent on you selling something, that has to be in the contract and it should be very clear as to what that property is. You should also have inspection contingencies in the contract. For instance, if the contract specifies that the seller is willing to fix $500 of minor repairs in the house, you bring in an inspection company, they find $450 worth of inspection repairs, everything's fine. You just move right along, the seller agrees to fix that stuff, and then you go to close. But if you pre-negotiated $500 in repair allowances, and the inspection report comes back at $1,000 or $1,500, and the seller is not willing to fix all that stuff, the contract's void. So the sale is contingent on a successful inspection, buyer-approved successful inspection. I know in Oklahoma, our repair allowances are pre-negotiated. My son bought a house, he lives in Dallas. The repair allowances weren't pre-negotiated. And I thought that was kind of an awkward thing where he agreed to pay whatever he paid for his house, and then he hired an inspection company to go out and take a look at it, and it had $2,000 or $3,000 worth of stuff. And there was a time there where he wasn't sure that the seller was going to do anything about it. Wasn't even sure the seller was willing to spend a dollar, let alone $3,000, and it ended up working out. But I like the fact that we can pre-negotiate a repair allowance based on the condition of the property when I looked at it. If it's obvious that it needs a roof, you need to include that in your offer. Offer is $150,000, seller to pay up to $4,000 in repairs to cover the cost of a roof. Be specific so that there's no questions. If you're buying a for sale by owner, you're probably not going to get an estimate of expenses, but in that case, you can use your good faith estimate that you got from a mortgage company. If you're dealing with a real estate company, they're going to give you an estimate of expenses so that you know how much money you're going to have to bring to closing after your credits for things that you've already paid for, like the appraisal, credit report, flood certification, home inspections, and whatever else you paid for outside of closing. You're going to get credit for that, and then you're going to have a balance due at closing. One of the things you do, obviously, before you write that contract and give it to the seller is you have to figure out how much you're going to offer for the property. It doesn't really matter what the list price is. Really don't let that influence your offer. If you know what you think the house is worth, that's what you should offer. There's a lot of houses on the market in Oklahoma City that are way overpriced. I mean, way over, that the sellers think their house is the best one on the street and blah, 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 blah. If you think it's only worth $125 and they want $225, offer $125. The worst thing you can do is say no. But know what your maximum offer is. If they came back at $130, you might decide to take it. And your maximum offer could be a full price offer. In a market that's moving fast, there's a shortage of housing, you find the perfect house, I always tell people, don't mess around. Don't try to save yourself $100 and lose the house. Offer them full price and move on. But you should always get a market analysis of the neighborhood. Know what that neighborhood's worth, because if you have to turn around and sell that property in 2 or 3 years, you want to make sure you don't pay way too much over what the value of the neighborhood is. I just got a request from a homeowner to do a market analysis on their home. And a gorgeous house, absolutely gorgeous. And I estimated $285,000 to $320,000. And they came back and said, oh, well, we're really disappointed in that. We thought it was worth a lot more. Well, I had really actually kind of pushed that, because they were actually in about a $200,000 neighborhood. But because they had some extra things, they had a tennis court and a little building on the tennis court and a big building, workshop, I gave them some extra credit. But they were way overbuilt for the area that they were in. And unfortunately, you know, they thought their house was worth $400,000. They'll never get that, because it'll never appraise for that much. They had it built. They had a custom home built. They had a $400,000 home built in a $200,000 neighborhood, which turned it into a $200,000 home. So make sure you understand what your neighborhood's worth. The other thing is important is how long you're going to live there. If you're there for 5 to 10 years, that maximum offer price may not be an issue for you. But if you're only going to be there for 2 years and you start out at the top of the market, if there's no appreciation, you're going to have a problem when it comes time to sell that home and getting what you paid for it. So either put a lot of money down or try to get it for slightly under what the market is for that area. Don't get stubborn. I run into a lot of buyers that kind of dig their heels in. Be flexible. Decide on a price, and if you can't get that price, move on. Don't get married to one house early in the game. There's probably plenty of houses out there. Just try to stay focused. Decide on a price. If you can't get that, move on to the next house. Once your offer has been submitted, I typically tell buyers there's one of four things that can happen. The seller can accept the offer just as you wrote it, sign it, give it back to you, and you start the process. The seller can reject the offer. Just write on there, rejected, give it back to you, and you're back at square one. The seller can counteroffer. In other words, you're going to submit an offer for $125,000, and they're going to counteroffer at $130,000. And then your choice is to accept it, reject it. The other thing that we use sometimes, which may or may not be the most ethical thing to do, is what I call the ignore. You offered $125,000, they counter back at $150,000, you don't do anything. You don't call them, you don't go see them, you don't answer them, you don't do anything. And make them sweat a little bit. I sold a house in Oklahoma City, and it'd been on the market for quite 120 days on the market. Well, I think they were asking $138,900. We went in with an offer for $130,000 and asked for $4,000 in closing costs paid by the seller. The listing realtor kind of laughed at me and told me, oh, well, you don't understand this market up here and this, that, and the other thing, which I had sold houses in that neighborhood before, and I did understand the market, which is why we wrote that offer the way we did. Well, they counteroffered actually over the asking price to cover the $4,000 that we put for closing costs. And so we chose the ignore. And about 3 days later, the listing realtor called me wanting to know what was going on with the counteroffer. And I said, well, there's nothing going on with the counteroffer. We made our offer, and the seller didn't agree to that offer, so we're out looking at houses. Oh. Anyway, a couple of days went by. She called me again and wanted to know, was there something that we could do? And I said, well, again, we made our offer. If the sellers are interested in that offer, then they can accept it. Well, this went on for 2 or 3 more days, and finally she called me again. I said, well, we're getting close to writing a contract on another home, which we were. I wasn't lying. They kind of found another home. They still like that one. If the sellers really wanted to do something, then they needed to take that offer, which they did. They ended up accepting $130,000, paid $4,000 in closing costs, and I think paid $1,000 in repairs. I did a lot of repair to the roof. And we closed. Everything was hunky-dory. Those same buyers turned around, called me 2 years later. They wanted a new house built, put their house back on the market, sold it for $139,000, paid no closing costs and no repairs. So there's a lot of things you can do in negotiation to get your way, but sometimes you have to be flexible. Like those sellers ended up having to be flexible. If you submit an offer and it flat out gets rejected, you can just resubmit another offer. If you think that you want the property and are willing to offer a little bit more, just rewrite a whole new contract and submit that. Make sure that everything is in there that you want. How long the house has been on the market does influence what the seller may be willing to accept, but I've seen a lot of houses that have been on the market a long time simply because the sellers wanted that much and they weren't going to sell it for a penny less. So just because a house has been on the market for 6 months doesn't mean you can steal it. It may mean that the seller's gotten plenty of other offers, but nobody's met their minimum yet. So you can take a stab at it, but time on market doesn't always influence price. Know what condition the property is in, even before you write that offer. So you should get yourself a checklist and look at the same things in every house that you go to. Construction methods, typically around the garage doors, is the weakest part of the house. It's the way they pour the foundations. So take a look around the garage doors for every house that you go to. See if there's any exterior cracks that might be some settlement issues. If you don't know anything about construction, you might want to have somebody with you that knows about construction. Hopefully your realtor knows about construction. But take a pretty good look at the house and make sure you look at the same things. And then make sure that's accounted for when you write your offer. In most cases, you cannot buy a home in an as-is condition if it's going to be financed. The mortgage company is going to send an appraiser out there to take a look at the property. If the appraiser sees something that's seriously wrong with that property, he or she is going to make a requirement that that be taken care of before closing. If it's a mortgage company selling that house, they're not going to fix anything. If the seller has already said, this house is as is, I'm not fixing anything, you might have wasted some inspection money and some appraisal money. So certainly talk to the mortgage company about an as-is purchase before you write a contract. There's a lot of houses that people don't, they buy them, they move in, they live in them for 3 years, they don't do anything. If you're going to be long-term in that house, you need to look at it from, does the property have a potential basis? So if it doesn't have any curb appeal at all, you might be able to put in some nice flower beds in the front, some trees, some grass, or whatever to really fix the property up. Shutters make a world of difference on a house, maybe some new windows. But there's a lot of things that you can do. If you can look at an ugly house and say, hey, this house is ugly today, but it has a lot of potential, that might be a really good purchase. It's probably been on the market for a while, and you might be able to get a pretty good deal on that. But again, be flexible. Know your limits. The other thing you have to understand is it a buyer's market or is it a seller's market? How many homes in the price range that you're shopping are on the market? If you're in the 150 to 175 range and there's only 10 houses, that's a seller's market. If you're in the 300 to 350 range and there's 100 houses, that's a buyer's market. So you kind of know how many homes are on the market in the price range that you're shopping at, because that'll determine whether it's a buyer or a seller's market. And it's not a buyer's market across the board, nor is it a seller's market across the board, because there may be some price ranges that have been overbuilt. I know here in Oklahoma City, when interest rates were down, we way overbuilt in the $300,000 to $350,000 price range. There was a gob of houses on the market, and they sat there for a long time, and the prices started coming down on those. But the houses in the 100 to 150 range couldn't find them, so they were getting premium dollar. After the contract is accepted by both parties, there's certain things that have to be done in a timely manner. Number one, you have to take a copy of the signed contract to your loan officer, because the mortgage company has to prepare the loan based on the contract. A copy of the contract has to go to the closing company or the title company. If you're working with a real estate company, the realtor typically takes care of that. If you're not, you need to make sure you get a copy of the contract to a closing company so they can start the title work and the closing papers based on the contract. The other thing you have to do is arrange for homeowner's insurance. I usually tell people you know, start with who you got your car insurance with. Typically, you can get a better deal if you have multiple policies with the same company. So if you've got two cars with Farmers Insurance, call Farmers and say, listen, I'm buying this house here. But get a couple quotes, because I talk about insurance in the next segment. Buying homeowners insurance is almost like getting a mortgage. They do credit checks. Some companies like to be in certain areas, don't like to be in other areas. So call two or three companies and get different quotes, but get quotes with, if you've got two cars, hey, I've got two cars and I want to buy a house, what kind of deal can I get on the entire package? So you might consider changing insurance companies on your car if your homeowner's insurance is way out of line. Here in Oklahoma, homeowner's insurance is very expensive, typically $300 a month for an average home because of our weather patterns that we have here. Make sure that the inspections are taken care of. Any requirements in the appraisal have to be corrected prior to closing. Any problems with the home inspection have to be taken care of to your satisfaction, by the way, not to the seller's satisfaction. Again, another little example, I sold a house to this young girl, and a squirrel had chewed a hole in the side of the house, was up in the attic. Well, they had gotten rid of the squirrel, and rather than really fix the hole, they just nailed a piece of board over it, and it looked terrible. So that wasn't done to the buyer's satisfaction. It was done to the seller's satisfaction because it didn't cost them anything. So we, in the contract, specified that that particular piece of material had to be changed out and done professionally. So the inspection repairs have to be done to your satisfaction, not the seller. The appraisal should be complete, turned into the mortgage company, and any requirements taken care of. Make sure the house appraised for what at least you're trying to pay for it. All the repairs are done. Just prior to closing, you want to do a walkthrough of the house to make sure all the repairs are completed and that the house is completely vacant. There was no additional damage caused to the house. We run into a lot of problems at this point because now all the furniture is out. That's when you really see the problems with the carpet, with the walls, and so on and so forth. So if you think there might be a problem, you might want to do your walkthrough a little bit more than 30 minutes prior to closing. You might want to go in a day early if the sellers are already vacated the property. But unfortunately, in a lot of cases, we see the sellers are out just in time to go to closing. And the next step is to get ready to move. Make sure everybody's notified, get all your bills changed over to your new address, get your utilities set up. I get a lot of calls from new buyers going, my water doesn't work, all the electricity went off. It's because I forgot to call the utility company to arrange to have the utilities put into their name as of the day of closing, because they'll come out and read the meters, they'll bill the seller for the period that they were in there, and then you'll pick up the new meter reading. So, and if you don't call in, the seller calls in to have them turned off, you're not going to have water the day after closing. That takes care of this segment on the purchase contracts and what to offer on a home. Our next segment is the homeowner's insurance. Again, please, if you get a minute, put some comments on iTunes for me or on Podomatic. Thanks for listening.